Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I said like you, I could not. That's when it got wheels off.
It's hard to pin down Shannon McNally, my guest on this episode of Wheels Off. She's been putting out records for almost 20 years, but she was almost an anthropologist / archaeologist. She is a guitar slinger, and she is a great singer, but she's a songwriter. You know, deeply personal stuff, like, you know, it's... A lot of times you get one thing from a person, and with Shannon, you get a lot. She's managed her own career for a number of years. She is, she's really cool. Shannon McNally is really cool, and I think you're going to love this conversation. We spoke virtually, of course, as these have been now for well over a year, because of the pandemic, which makes it tough, but it makes it easier. You know, I wasn't going to be able to fly down to Austin to sit in a room with her this week. So it was nice to be able to speak to her. The virtualness of it took its toll on the connection. At one point, we got cut off. I think the producers will be able to patch it back together in a way that maybe you won't even notice. Every once in a while, the digital crackle makes itself annoying, but I don't think it's bad. I think it's everybody now is pretty used to the way these things work, and it's worth it. Shannon McNally has got a lot of great insight. She's got a really great, take on the world, and I'm so glad I got to sit down with her for this episode of Wheels Off. Please welcome Shannon McNally. Welcome to Wheels Off, Shannon McNally. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Rhett Miller.
Oh, this is so cool. For the edification of our listeners, from where are you joining us?
I am in Austin, Texas right now.
Nice. In a beautiful yellow room.
Yes, in the yellow room.
And also, this will be primarily consumed via audio, or maybe only consumed via audio. But I should point out that you have an incredible turquoise ring. Or is that lapis? What is that?
It is turquoise. It is turquoise. Yes.
Really great.
My favorite jewelry.
So I know I've caught you on a day that obviously has got a little bit of being at home family stuff, but also work. I wonder, what creative project are you working on right now, and how is it lighting you up?
Well, I was just out in Marfa, Texas with Terry Allen and the Panhandle Mystery Band, which is another project that of mine. And we get together, you know, we couldn't obviously do it over the pandemic, but we generally get together like twice a year. We hole up at the Marfa Theater at St. George Hotel in Marfa and write, which, you know, Terry's just he sort of spearheads it. And then and then great people came in this year. I was Buck Allen and Joe Harvey, Allen, John Doe, and Charlie Sexton. So it was really, really nice. And then we were writing, and simultaneously, so, you know, most times you write, and somebody hits a little voice memo, and you record what you've done, you know. But we recorded right on the spot, multi-track right on the spot. So the songs were written and recorded, you know, one a day.
God, I love that.
It was pretty impressive, actually. After we did six songs this time, so it was like a pow, you know. And it's not like it's a real collaborative process. It's not as goofy as co-writing, you know, because there's like all these really great people just going, okay, we're gonna finish the song, and it's gonna be great. So no, you know, no weird writing demos, no weird like, well, we'll finish it sometime. We're not gonna finish it sometime. We'll finish it right
now. It's funny. So you're speaking in a little bit of a shorthand to me, because you know that I know that vibe of being on Music Row or wherever in a dumb office with somebody that maybe you just met and you're put together by a publisher. It's a really weird thing.
I try not to do too much of it. I find it kind of creepy. You know, I mean, I've tried it off and on for years. Songwriter Carousel and stuff like that, you know. But my friend Steve Earle says about co-writing, it's like sex. It shouldn't be done in public. It's weird, you know. It's weird. But this is a little bit different because these are people I know really well, and we all have great chemistry. It's a band. It's a band. It's my band. So
I love it.
Yeah.
And you got Charlie Sexton there, who can make things sound good. I mean, actually, pretty much everybody there can make things sound good.
Everybody's kind of amazing. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, for sure.
With something like that, did you? I will try not to ask you too many questions about that specific event experience, because that sounds fascinating to me. I love the idea of on the spot collaboration like that. For you, did you bring in like a notebook filled with ideas? Did you have partially finished songs? What did you show up with, or did you really start blank slate?
You know, well, I would say half the songs, somebody will pitch an idea. Somebody will just have the tiniest start or a verse or a line. But we did pretty cold start for most of them. And it just it's a very organic group, and they're all really great. They're super creative bunch, you know. Because Terry's not just a songwriter; he's also a world class visual artist. You know, like a serious artist, sculptor, painter, draws. And Joe Harvey, they write plays. I mean, like, they're incredible. So just a highly creative group. So we started cold with a lot of it, you know, and it's really like volleyball. We were joking. It's like volleyball. It's just like keep the ball in the air and you know, just like this from one person to the other person sitting in the round, you know? Yeah. And it's very egoless. Nobody says no. I mean, we think of this particular collaborative process. It's like volleyball, you know, keep the ball in the air and keep it moving. And it's just a fun group, and everybody's ideas are great. So you can follow any one of them, and it's safe. You know, there's so it's really fun. I've never written in a band setting like that. So it's really fresh to me because I've never done that.
If that's something that comes up a lot in these conversations, is the idea, especially when I talk to musicians, is the idea of collaboration being such a thing that drew us to this, you know, like the community of people who are supporting each other and excited about each other's ideas. And it's funny because you've had a lot of experience as probably a pretty self-driven solo artist, the boss.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
now part of a larger thing's got to be weird.
Yeah, you know, it's I've done a lot of collaboration on, but never quite like this, never like a band. I've done one-on-one, you know. But yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I've always wanted to be a band. I just never could pull it off. You know, it just never happened. It's like, it's, you know, so I always wanted to be in a band. That to me is like the whole point of it, you know, but since it never really manifested, I have bands, you know, but yeah. I mean, I can't think of anything more fun than a 5-piece band, you know, or 6-piece band.
So when you were, it's been super fun to watch your career over the years. I love seeing when people like evolve and do different stuff and challenge themselves. And I feel like that's been a hallmark of what you've done. I wonder about when you were starting out, when you're saying like when you were first visualizing what you were going to do, thinking about being in a band, was this always the thing? Do you always remember knowing it was going to be music? Do you remember the moment at which you, was there an epiphany moment where you knew it was, this was it?
Yeah, there was an epiphany moment. I mean, I really sort of tuned in around 12 when I got my first guitar, and I was really into blues. I was really into guitar players, lead guitar players, you know, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and arena rock at the time, you know. And I saw Tom Petty and Heartbreakers when I was 15 at NASA Coliseum, and I had that epiphany moment, like that complete chakra opening where you know, you're not sure if you peed your pants or not. You're just, oh, you know. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be that guy right there. Not the drummer, not the bass player, none of that. No, that guy right there. And, you know, I was in school. I was fairly academic. I was fairly academia bound. But the music kind of kept interrupting that. So, and then I got signed, you know, then I had this pivotal moment where it was like, either I was going to go on, I was an anthropology, archaeology major, and I was going to either go dig right after college, or I was going to go to LA because I met Los Lobos, and I was like, I think I'm going to go to LA. Do I want to like be down in like a cave in France with a toothbrush all summer? Or do I want to go see Los Lobos on the pier? I'll go see Lobos.
Is there an overlap in the Venn diagram between anthropology, specifically maybe archaeology, but anthropology and songwriting? Do you think there's the study of human life, emotions, whatever?
Completely. I mean, really, you know, anthropology is all observation and writing and theory, you know, theoretical writing. The reason I left anthropology is because I felt like a lot of the applied anthropology was to exploit people. You know, it was like you get hired by an oil company, or you get hired by a mining company, or whoever, you know, so that you, and then you become the middleman between the community, and you know, you sort of translate the cultural, how is this other entity going to pimp this cultural situation? So I kind of lost interest in it because I didn't like the applied, I didn't like a lot of the applications of it. Not that I loved the subject matter, but I didn't like the applications of it. And songwriting really is the same thing. It's all, you know, observing, and it's all ethnography. It's all observing somebody or yourself, and then seeing how do I fit into this cultural group? Do I not fit into this cultural group? It's just observation and writing. So, you know, and then, but it's just on, you know, everybody specializes. So, you know, you don't know the whole world. You specialize on one little teeny, tiny, tiny, tiny aspect. One little group of people, or one, you know, whatever. So, yeah, it all ties back to songwriting because it's all observation.
If you had wound up in an applied anthropology field, what do you think your specialty would have been? What group?
I was particularly fascinated with the Andes, with high altitude in South America, mountain life over 10,000 feet, and childbirth, child rearing. You know, it's really different. You can't give birth over 10,000 feet. But just the way that the shape of your body is decided by where your ancestors came from. You know, that was pretty interesting to me. You know, I was really a religious anthropology major, but I was sort of fascinated, and I was mostly fascinated with the New World, but I was also fascinated with how your environment literally shapes your body.
That's pretty incredible. I obviously know a lot of musicians, but I don't know anybody from that background. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was a nerd. You know?
did you have anybody in your life that was particularly upset when you decided to throw all that away and go into rock and roll?
No, I mean, I think my family, there were no musicians or artists in my family. They were all very sort of working class, you know, Long Island, New York City, old New York City, you know. And they all worked from the time they were 14 or 15 years old. They worked for their whole lives. They started working and smoking at the same time, and they did it until they died, you know. but my folks, neither one of my folks went to college, and they were both excited for me to go, you know, and they were the first in there on either side to sort of make any money in the 80s. And so they were able to put me through college, and I went to a real good school. But I was the first, you know, and it was kind of a shock to me too. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I want to go to law school, and I don't want to go to medical school. I don't think I want to go to grad school. And in anthropology, if you don't go to grad school, it's not a thing. You got to go to grad school. So, and the music just kind of took over. And when I graduated, they were like, "You're going to do what? Like, how?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. You know, I really don't know. I have no idea how you do this, but it keeps calling me." So they were supportive though. They were excited that it wasn't, you know, that I wasn't going to, you know, go be a regular job, you know, because, they were all, my folks were all self-employed. You know, they weren't rich people, but they were all self-employed, and they were creative, and they were, you know, kind of scrappy. So I figured they weren't too worried. They were a little worried, but they weren't too worried. And they thought I was good at what I did. They didn't know where songs came from. So they were amazed that you could write songs anyway. You know, like, how do you do that? This happens. I just made it up.
It is kind of amazing, though. It's a little bit like magic. It's there's nothing, and then there's something.
Yeah. Oh, it's complete magic. It's complete magic. I think, you know, when it's good, it's magic. You know when it's magic.
That's sweet. So you seem like somebody who just, you know, as an outside observer, you seem like somebody who's always been pretty comfortable in your own skin and self-confident, and you have an idea where you're going. Pretty much everybody I've ever spoken to in about this stuff deals with, self-generated obstacles, you know, interior stuff that, you know, voices in your head, imposter syndrome, the kind of things that want to keep us from creating. And I just wonder what you have figured out to deal with those kind of internally generated obstacles.
That's an interesting question. I would say that for me, the hardest part has been my guitar, has been my instrument, I think, because when I started playing guitar, you know, it was the mid 80s, I was 12 years old. Bonnie Raitt and Hart were about it, you know, Joni Mitchell. You didn't see women guitar players, and you didn't see women rock guitar players or blues guitar players. It was very, you know, there's no escaping how phallic the guitar is. It's just, you know, I mean, the Stones and the Who and Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. I mean, it's an extension of them, of their bodies. And I think that was always a little embarrassing to me, maybe, but I was so fascinated with the guitar and I kind of couldn't help but want to play it. So there might have been, I think there's always been a little bit of a block there. As much as I've tried to get past it, and I have at times, you know. But I think that I have an unreasonable standard. I have an unreasonable standard for guitar playing. I really do. I don't know that I'll ever really meet it. And so that's probably it. I'm never going to be Jimmy Page. And that's always going to bother me.
That's a pretty high standard.
That's never going to stop bothering me. I'm never going to be Dwayne Allman, and that's never going to stop bothering me. And although I think that at times I have channeled that kind of, I can get close to that dominant feeling. I just don't know that. I don't know. That gets in the way. It doesn't always make the whole process, you know. I'm always fascinated with people who are just those open wires, you know, who can just channel straight from the other side. And so I probably have unreasonable expectations of myself.
Ah, that's fascinating. I didn't expect that it would be that sort of self-criticism. But I wonder, right, like those people that make it look so easy, you know, I don't know, Gary Clark in Austin, right? You see that guy and he's just does it, you know, and or whoever. I wonder, do they must have voices in their head as well. I mean, I know Gary. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, rock and roll wouldn't be laden with drug addiction if not. You know, everybody's got some voice. Everybody's got something they're chasing. And, you know, and I think that at some point you just make peace with that and you learn to live with it and you still carry on. I mean, I still, you know, I know when I had a good show and I know when I connected with the audience and I know when I wrote something really good. And I also, at some point, I stopped doubting, you know, I stop listening to my own thoughts. I've learned that I am not my thoughts. I have a lot of thoughts. Everybody's got, you know, 70,000 thoughts a day. Most of them are negative. Very few of them are different or new or original. And you got to stop listening to them. You have to step aside and observe them. It's all anthropology. You just have to observe. You have to observe them or you're a slave to them. So, you know, I don't think I'm naturally, I don't like to be a slave to myself or to anybody else. And that's why I play music. But that's also why, you know, and then you have those moments where you get those gigs that, like, you got that gig. Your record collection didn't, your mind, you know, who you think you are, I didn't want, you know, you got that gig. And then you're out there and you're doing it and you don't, and I always, when I get like a really good gig or like, I go out and open for somebody who I really love and admire, or I, you know, make a record with Dr. John or somebody like that. I'm confident that I don't have the right to then question that they make the right decision. They made the decision to take me out there or to do this with me. And therefore I'm going to trust them because I've been trusting them for a long time. You know, I've been reacting to their music and then their decision-making process. And then their decision-making process includes me tonight. And I'm on the stage with them. So I'm not in a position to second guess that. And I trust that.
Oh my God, I love that. That's so funny because it comes up a lot in this, the idea that the way past these voices, the negative voices or whatever, is to step aside and watch them, right? But usually when it comes up, it's talked about in terms of meditation, right? Where you let the voices come and happen and then they go away. But for you to talk about it in terms of, like, you know, anthropological remove and like empirical evidence, like Dr. John, like he's empirically proven himself to be trustworthy. You're going to use his judgment and, you know, like that kind of stuff. That's fantastic.
I mean, not all subjects, but when it comes to music, yeah, I trust Dr. There's things I would not joke to Dr. John with, but he's not one of them. Is it right? I trust you.
Maybe not.
Whatever
babe,
you say.
Baby.
Yeah.
All right. So momentarily, I'm going to ask you to distill this wisdom like you've been sharing with us. In the meantime, I'm going to, we'll step aside and hear a word from our sponsors in 3, 2, 1. And we're back. So I'm wondering, Shannon McNally, our guest on Wheels Off, I'm wondering if you were to meet a 21-year-old version of yourself in today's messed up world, what advice might you give yourself?
Well, I would say, that's funny, that's hard. I would say, I hope you like to drive, go driving, make sure you have a driver's license. I would say turn off, and I would get off social media for a year, and don't look at social media for a year or two. 21, you're really young, and you have a lot of time in front of you, and I would say drive around the country, turn off social media, write your songs, do some other stuff. Because, your songs are interesting because of who you are and what you've done. And if you go straight to the co-writing thing, or you go straight to, you can't mine, you got nothing to mine. I mean, maybe you do. Maybe you had a really rich, emotional landscape in childhood, and your songs are pretty good, but I just think that there's so much coming at everybody, and it's distracting, and it's not. I don't think it's healthy. I think social media. You need to, all of my favorite songwriters are my favorite songwriters because they didn't have to one, come up with content all day, every day. They didn't think about this thing. Townes Van Zandt did not care about anything but writing a good song and then serving that song. He did it for the sake of the song. And, that's the same Guy Clark. It's the same of all of, it's just like, I can look back at that generation of previous generation, all previous generations, none of them had to deal with social media. And that's where you see the shift in the quality of the writing and the quality of the production. Everybody's in such a hurry. Everybody's got everything compartmentalized. Everybody's got all this noise in their head, all this stuff that they're constantly reacting to. Turn it off. I would turn it off and keep it off for a while and go live some life. And, I don't know. Enjoy it, enjoy your life. Go see, find good live music. And when you find something that really rocks your boat live, or, for me, it's about live. For me, it's like everything I write, everything I do, is this going to work? I hear it live in my head when it's happening, when I'm writing it, when I'm recording it, I don't compartmentalize this. This is just fun writing. This is fun recording. This is fun live. To me, the end result is always I want to perform this. I want to do this. And I want to be around those people who really inspire me, seek them out. I've sought out everybody I ever really truly admired, and just standing next to them is informative, you don't even have to have anything clever to say or whatever, just meeting them, people say don't meet your heroes, but don't invest too much in it, but meet them, meet them, seek them out. Don't be a jerk. Don't be an asshole. No one to go away, but meet them, if that's who you think you're, if you're drawn to that. I would say go to the things you're truly drawn to, but avoid social media. If I was 21 right now, I'd say get off social media. Who knows? Who cares what, you know, it's going to change 1,000 times between now and when you need to figure out how to do it. So I don't know. I think social media is going to wear itself out to some degree. It's almost painful. You know, it gets painful. And I think it's too much on the brain and it's not serving the music because it's confusing. So my 21-year-old self, long story short, I would say get off social media and seek out the people that really inspire you and at least stand in the same room with them or meet them or, you know, don't be crazy about it, but don't be weird. but, you know, get in there and breathe the same air they're breathing for a minute or two.
It's funny to that point how when you meet those folks that you in your mind build them up to be bigger than life or magic or, you know, superhuman. That's one of the best things, right, is that you realize they are human beings and it makes it seem like it's more possible for you to do something like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think humanizing your heroes is really important. And not being mad at them for, you know, being whatever they are. You know, if they lived long enough and they did, it's just not an easy existence, you know. And whether they did it, you know, whether they did it at the upper echelons of success and rock and roll mania and crazy, you know, jets all over the place and pounds of kilos of cocaine and bad behavior and, you know, insanity, or they were real humble or whatever, however they were, observe it and take that part of it for yourself that you like, but you can sift through it. You know, they did you the big favor of, you can live vicariously a little bit through them. You don't have to do all the stupid shit they to come out on the other side.
And I love that you're it right there in your advice. Such a big part of it is get out there and experience. And when you were right around that same age, forced with the decision between going into the bottom of a hole in France and dusting off antiquities versus going to LA with Los Lobos or whatever, you made the choice to live life and experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Neanderthal bones in the south of France, that probably would have led to interesting things, but when it came down to it, I'm addicted to the way of an amplifier just hums at you when it's real loud and when it's, you know, I chase that God. That's all.
Yeah. There's a Bowie quote that I come back to that was some interview in Rolling Stone around 2001, 2002, and David Bowie, they asked him, now that the music industry is collapsing and there's not going to be any money left, do you think that people will still do it? And he said, I think it's great. I think that the people who are in it for the money will leave and the people who have no choice will be the ones left doing it. And that's what you make me think of, you deciding to chase this wild dream.
Yeah, I mean, I remember hearing all that. You know, I was on Capitol Records when they were really trying to sell it and get rid of it. And Napster had just come along and it was like, and they were all just hysterical, you know, but beside themselves, and it's the end of the music industry and it's this and it's that. And it was like rats jumping off the Titanic. And, you know, I mean, it's not, the music business didn't really start that long ago. It's not that old. It only started, I mean, a Bill Graham didn't, you know, the Fillmore West was really like the first, you know, Warner Brothers signing the Grateful Dead and the Fillmore West. That was it. That was the beginning. You know, that was the beginning of the way we know it now. And that's only, what, 66, 65, whatever that was, you know, I mean, not that long ago. So this idea that it's not going to shift and change and, you know, kind of make itself obscure for a while, you know, it's a self-indulgent. It's very self-indulgent. You know, it wasn't maintainable the way it was, the way it started out initially. And that's why it killed so many people. That's why there were so many rock and roll casualties. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think the people who have to do it are always going to do it. And they're always going to, you know, and And God bless them. That's really all you want to hear. Those are the only people you really want to hear make music, because the rest of it's just noise, cluttering up the, you know, the frequency waves. It's like, shut up. You know, just
man. Well, I'm
hey.
I'm really glad that you got called to do this thing. And I'm really grateful that you sat down and carved out a chunk of your day to speak with me. Thank you so much, Shannon, for being on Wheels Off.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.